Trickstar kind of had that same mythologizing and gossip and rumor situation going on that you get with, like, you know, a lot of other sort of offbeat groups and artists like Syd Barrett and Skip Spence and people like that. So I always knew that the story was interesting and nothing was ever really confirmed. But furthermore, I just always thought of them as being, you know, a very, just part of the canon of rock and roll, just kind of having a very esteemed position. But as we started to make this film, I started to learn that not a lot of people knew that. And even though if you opened up any 100 greatest records of all time, the Big Star Records would have been in there, people weren't really aware of that, especially younger kids. Anyone under 30, I kept finding they had no idea who the band was, but usually knew someone who was influenced by the band. And oftentimes would have thought that someone like Elliott Smith wrote 13 or Jeff Buckley did Kangaroo. You know, no one knew where these songs came from.
Is this movie more about trying to show everybody what their influence was, or you're reaching out to fans who get that, or exposing more of the story to people who really don't know anything about them?
The film is really not about doing what I was just talking about. The film became a part of the agenda only after we had been touring it around the festivals and I saw the disparity of people, of music fans that knew about Big Star. In the beginning, it was really just to tell a really great story. I think that was what I was consumed with for so long. And there was so much story that there didn't even seem to be room to talk about the resurgence of the band. But as we continued, people kept asking for it. And then it started to seem that it was needed. And it actually worked out just fine. I think the balance is perfect. But the story of the band is just so compelling. And there's just so many different details. And, you know, the original cut of the film was like 5 hours long. So, you know, it was really hard to whittle it down. It took a long time to find that balance to help bring in new fans and people that knew about the band as well.
Well, you mentioned covers of songs. I mean, I wonder how many people are aware that the theme from that 70s show was originally their song and not a Cheap Trick.
You know, I thought most people knew that, and very few know that. And in a way, it's not the best way to promote Big Star. I mean, it's a theme song to a sitcom, you know, and that song seems to be just kind of like a tossed-off kind of fun pop song. To me, 70s show doesn't even really promote the whole idea of Big Star. In a way, that's what makes the story so interesting is the disconnect and the way that the culture has continued to filter out Big Star. It's moved out in all kinds of weird places, from 70s show to the Bangles, and Big Star's music has been in movies. It's just interesting how all that happens.
Were you surprised by maybe some artists that were already excited to talk about them?
We always knew that there was a huge cadre of 90s people that would have known about Big Star and usually name-checked Big Star, like people from R.E.M., the Replacements, who we never thought we would be speaking with anyway. You know, the Posies from the Northwest were part of Big Star when they reformed, so that was obvious. Evan Dando, people like that. But what happened later on, which was really exciting, is that the British side of things, where people like Alexis Taylor from Hot Chip, and they're an electronic band, just to learn that the Jesus and Mary Chain, when they first came out in like 1980, were touring the States on a hunt for Big Star records. That was all that they wanted, were listening to at the time. The diverse mass of musicians that have listened to this band is what really is interesting to me. That term power pop, I find it's very limiting if you talk about Big Star. And what I've learned is that it really doesn't mean anything, because the genres, the various genres that they've influenced are really huge.
Why weren't they bigger?
We do go into sort of the technical reasons why. It has a lot to do with the machinations of the music industry at that time as it became more corporatized. You know, they were just living in Memphis, Tennessee, and kind of doing things the old way, the old-fashioned way, which was kind of like having an independent label and put your stuff out there and get it on regional radio. And so we get into that. But as a storyteller, I'm much more interested in the idea that they would have never made it, that there was just something in their DNA that was going to keep them from becoming mainstream. And that's what makes them so beautiful, is that they were tossed into this limbo of non-commercial underground music when that was not a very fun place to be. But later on, in the mid to late 70s, it became a very groovy place to be. But there were a lot of elements of their, you know, their music was just sort of a little too subtle. It was somewhat revivalist, and it wasn't complex. It wasn't about, you know, flashy guitar solos, or there was some bombastic drumming, but it also wasn't about attitude. It was, you know, as far as the way the songs are written, there's this element of exuberance, but also this sort of melancholy in the songs, too. So it's just not that commercial. And Memphis itself is not that commercial. So that's kind of a big part of the story as well, is talking about the influence of Memphis on their music.
Won't you tell your dad, get off my back? Tell him what we said about painted black. Rock and roll is here to stay. Come inside, well, it's okay. Now shake you.
Ooh. Where did they fit in within the Memphis culture?
Well, I think that when you talk about Memphis music, you can really simplify it by talking about it as being a soulful town. It certainly is. We're talking about early rock and roll and Elvis. But to me, the mentality of Memphis music was a very strong individualist spirit. You know, Elvis Presley was a unique person. I mean, he was a white guy that dug black culture when that was not cool, and when actually that probably could have been a problem for you. And that music was not popular when he started making it. And that's a point that Jim Dickinson makes, and we're going to put that on our DVD extras. But, you know, rock and roll was a very niche market in the early 50s for just a bunch of white guys with pompadours dressing up like black pimps. And, you know, that caught on. And the same thing with soul music. I mean, who knew that white people would get into soul music? I mean, it was gospel with a backbeat. You know, and if you do want to talk about is there a Memphis sound in Big Star's music, I mean, I do hear the soul element to their songs, which is just being very true in your singing and your performances. And there's no artifice with Big Star.
Maybe you have a couple of favorite songs of theirs?
I can't even do it. I mean, you know, I like almost all of them, especially now that I know so much about the songs and where they come from. I think also, you know, as I always say about Big Star, they're somewhat deceptive because, you know, when you listen to them at first, it's just you take an instant liking. I mean, that it's just so easy to listen to, but as you continue listening, there's just kind of these other layers to it, especially when you pick up on the lyrics and stuff. I do see the progression, though, in there as kids to... you know, young adults to, you know, men, as they're becoming somewhat disenchanted, and you can hear that in the records. I just hope that we can bring in new fans. I think that this band, you know, as I said before, I just feel like that they sort of lost some of their cachet in the past 10 years or so, and they're still just as timeless as ever. So I just hope that we get, you know, more people to listen to this music.